This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Judge Brett Kavanaugh's Supreme Court nomination now comes down to one last vote. Today, senators voted 51-49 to end debate over the nomination. The yes votes included three senators who are considered swing votes: Democrat Joe Manchin, Republican Susan Collins, and Republican Jeff Flake. Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska was the only Republican to vote no. She later told NBC News that she literally made up her mind as she walked into the Senate chamber. Now, today's vote does not necessarily reflect whether senators will confirm Kavanaugh. That vote is expected this weekend. Having said that, Senator Flake says he will vote to confirm. You'll get full coverage on your NPR member station and online at npr.org. And by the way, before we dive in, today's Friday News Roundup aired live at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. That was before and during the Senate vote. With that in mind, we'll dive into the roundup. The Domestic Hour is up first, right after this.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Grow with Google. Digital skills are becoming more and more important in today's economy. That's why Grow with Google is providing free online training and tools to help Americans learn the skills they need to succeed. Learn more about Grow with Google and get started by visiting google.com/grow.
You've certainly heard some variation of the phrase, be a man.
Are you a real man?
You must be gay.
Man up. Manhood is something that's hard to earn and easy to lose.
Masculinity threats, this week on Hidden Brain.
Man up. Man up. Gay.
A woman's job. A woman's job. A woman's job.
Joining us this week to try to make sense of what's been going on and what may yet go on this weekend is Eugene Scott, political reporter for The Washington Post. Eugene, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Susan Glasser, a staff writer for The New Yorker and a global affairs analyst for CNN. Hey, Susan.
Hi there.
And joining us from WBEZ Public Radio in Chicago is Steve Clemens, the Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic. Steve, glad to have you with us.
Great to be with you, Joshua.
Let's back up with Kavanaugh. Of course, there were big developments in the confirmation process, including yesterday. The day began with senators reviewing the completed FBI report into allegations of sexual violence and misconduct, the ones that were brought by Professor Christine Blasey Ford. A few hours later, hundreds of protesters, including actor Amy Schumer, were arrested at a big demonstration outside the U.S. Supreme Court. The rally was against confirming Kavanaugh. And as the day closed out, the judge himself published an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal advertising his impartiality as a judge and explaining why he was so volatile during last week's testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Let's talk about how the FBI report might influence the outcome. But first, let's hear from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Here is part of what he told reporters yesterday, flanked by other Republican members of the Senate.
What we know for sure is the FBI report did not corroborate any of the allegations against Judge Kavanaugh. And the second thing we know for sure is that there's no way anything we did would satisfy the Democrats. They've always got a reason why the goalposts need to be moved farther down the field, and nothing we could do would satisfy them. They're dug in. You've seen it from the beginning.
That's Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell speaking yesterday. Eugene Scott, what do we know about the FBI report? I mean, what we know about what was in it, what wasn't in it, and how it was received by senators on either side of the aisle?
Well, we do know that how people responded to the investigation varies greatly based on the side of the aisle that they fall on. We certainly saw Senator Feinstein communicate that she just thought the investigation was incomplete and therefore insufficient and not getting to the bottom of what it was that was concerning her and lawmakers like her. And then we had Susan Collins, who was pleased with it and who I think voters are looking to hear from more later on today, who will therefore try to share more about why she felt the investigation was sufficient. Many of the people that wanted to testify or share their stories with the FBI, literally dozens, were not able to get in contact with the FBI and definitely felt left out of the investigation. And so how much information this includes just seems to be not clear and therefore insufficient to most people paying attention.
You know, we really don't have any public sense of exactly what was in it. There was like one paper copy of the report that senators had to review in one room. So it was kind of intentionally kept very, very much under wraps. Judge Kavanaugh published an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal kind of defending his testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee on Thursday. I want to read a piece of that, Eugene, and I'd like to get your sense of what impact that might have, if any. In part, Judge Kavanaugh wrote, quote, "I testified before the Judiciary Committee last Thursday to defend my family, my good name, and my lifetime of public service. My hearing testimony was forceful and passionate. That is because I forcefully and passionately denied the allegation against me." He goes on to write, quote, "I was very emotional last Thursday, more so than I have ever been. I might have been too emotional at times. I know that my tone was sharp, and I said a few things I should not have said. I hope everyone can understand that I was there as a son, husband, and dad. I testified with five people foremost in my mind: my mom, my dad, my wife, and most of all, my daughters," unquote. I know we have to pause in a moment, but Eugene, do we have a sense that this op-ed will have any impact on the outcome?
He certainly is hoping so, and that's in part because the conversation for many lawmakers has shifted away from the sexual assault allegations to his temperament. And I think what he was trying to explain is that this was an exceptional moment for me. I actually do have the ability to display the even toneness that it is that many people are expecting of me if given this opportunity. And so perhaps he was hoping to assuage some fears. Whether or not it actually will or not, we will see soon.
The president's been pretty vocal about this whole process in the last few days, has been for some time, but it's been turning increasingly negative as the week's gone on. On Tuesday, the president held a rally and took the opportunity to mock Kavanaugh's accuser, Professor Christine Blasey Ford, and question her account of events.
36 years ago, this happened. I had one beer, right? I had one beer. Well, do you think it was? Nope, it was one beer. Oh, good. How did you get home? I don't remember. How'd you get there? I don't remember. Where is the place? I don't remember. How many years ago was it? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. What neighborhood was it in? I don't know. Where's the house? I don't know. Upstairs, downstairs, where was it? I don't know. But I had one beer. That's the only thing I remember. And a man's life is in tatters. A man's life is shattered. His wife is shattered. His daughters, who are beautiful, incredible young kids. They destroy people. They want to destroy people. These are really evil people.
Part of what President Trump said to supporters at a rally in Minnesota on Tuesday. Steve Clemens, we should note, first of all, what the president said is untrue. Professor Ford did not say that the only thing she remembered was having one beer. Ironically, she said the thing she most remembered was being laughed at by Brett Kavanaugh and his friend Mark Judge, who was allegedly in the room when this happened. So there's a little bit of irony with the crowd laughing at her over the president's account. So we should clear that up. But I wonder, more to the point, whether or not the White House has addressed those remarks.
Look, I was on stage just on the other day with Kellyanne Conway, asking her about these, the president's temperament, and about her own revelations about sexual assault that had happened in her life and why she chose to share that. And she acknowledged that she didn't choose to share, that it just came out. The president's behavior is something that makes many people around the president of the United States today extremely uncomfortable. They have, at the beginning of this process, were trying to be respectful, to say that Dr. Ford needed to be heard and listened to, that there were important issues there. And the president broke out of those constraints. And we're sitting, as I'm sure Susan Glasser and Eugene will comment as well, in a very extraordinary moment where many Americans and their experiences that have gone through with many other sexual assault victims in the past who have kept quiet and said this way, even Susan Collins, who's now probably in a position to vote in favor of Judge Kavanaugh, has said, you know, people do not talk about this. These are the most underreported incidents. And I would like to add just to Eugene's comment about Kavanaugh's Wall Street Journal op-ed, that was written for one person. That was written for not Donald Trump. It was written for Senator Flake. Senator Flake at the Atlantic Festival this week said that we could not have the kind of temperament that Kavanaugh showed on the Supreme Court. He says, we cannot have that on the court. We just cannot. And he was referring specifically to Kavanaugh going after senator after senator after senator after his very emotional opening statement. And that was a message to give Flake cover to also vote for Kavanaugh. So we're sitting here where people are walking away from the allegations and the tumult that many women and their partners and others supporting them feel about this being shoved under the rug,
right,
while others are getting essentially fig leaves and passes to be able to vote for Kavanaugh.
Yeah, he did have a lot of very sharp exchanges with Senator Amy Klobuchar and Patrick Leahy and Dick Durbin and many of the Democrats who questioned him last Thursday. A few more quick questions, and then we'll keep going. Let me get to some of your comments as well. Virginian in Washington, D.C. writes, Democratic obstructionism? Merrick Garland. And Susan in Gainesville, Florida asks, what on earth is the rationale for only one copy of the report of 45 pages being provided for review by 100 senators? Susan, clearly a lot of things for voters to carry in their not at all distant memories when they go to the polls in November, go to the polls next month. Do we have any real hard, reliable sense? Is there any evidence of how much this may affect the midterm elections? I mean, a lot of what voters vote on in the midterms doesn't have to do with what happens in Washington. Some of it does. A lot of it has to do with what happens at home. Do we have a sense of what the balance is looking like right now?
Well, look, first of all, it does depend, in fact, on how this ends. And there is an interesting argument to be made that if Kavanaugh is confirmed, it's much more likely, in a way, to somewhat fade as an issue for Republican voters while becoming an enormous rallying cry for Democrats. And conversely, were he to go down, especially in such a spectacular fashion so close to the election, there's already a sense, and President Trump clearly feels this, which is why he's been ginning up his voters over the last week on this, that were Kavanaugh to go down, that this would outrage and enrage Republican-based voters in a way that could prove beneficial, especially in some of these key Senate races, which are already taking place largely on a favorable to Republicans playing field this fall. What's unusual about this divisive fight? We've had many divisive fights before. It strikes me that this is coming so close to a midterm election. Therefore, it's injecting a volatile note of uncertainty with just weeks to go to the election, number one. Number two, it is a cultural war being ignited, arguably, among Democrats and Republicans. While both sides, I wrote last week about the two Americas that would listen to the very jarringly different accounts offered by Dr. Ford and Brett Kavanaugh and would process this hearing in a completely different way. I think we've all watched that playing out over the last week. Political tribe in our increasingly tribally divided culture has a whole different fact set, a whole different narrative, a whole different argument to make. It's inflaming passions on both sides. Republicans have made a lot over polls in recent days showing that Republican voter enthusiasm, which had been very low, very turned off in this midterm election year, has sparked upwards over the last week. You could argue, well, that's just the election getting closer anyways. Right. We're not sure how much it has to do with Kavanaugh. But my guess is that, you know, for different parts of the country, this works entirely differently politically.
Let's move on to some of the other big stories that made news this week, including with immigration policy. Roughly 300,000 immigrants from El Salvador, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Sudan have gotten a temporary reprieve after the Trump administration threatened to revoke their temporary protected status, or TPS. This week, a federal judge in California put the administration's plans on hold for now. If the plan does eventually go through, hundreds of thousands of people with TPS will be forced to leave the U.S. over the next year. Eugene, temporary protected status is one of these things that protects folks from other countries who come to the U.S. under exigent circumstances, like after the Haiti earthquake. People who came to the U.S. from Haiti were kind of insulated from immigration enforcement because they came here as a result of a natural disaster, for example. Give us a sense of the Trump administration's argument for removing this TPS and how the court reacted to that.
Well, we haven't heard much about it this week, given everything, but we know on Wednesday night a federal judge put a hold on the administration's plans to stop renewing the legal status of about 300,000 people from these countries. And all the four countries that we were talking about were already set to lose this status. And if the immigrants who lived here for years don't have the status, they can risk deportation. I think it's just consistent with the president's policies related to immigrants and decreasing the number of people in this country coming from other countries. Because there, it still plays into the idea that the economy is being taken, jobs are being operated by, the jobs are being occupied by immigrants from these places that are taking jobs from Americans. And many of the people in his base, despite the fact that the unemployment rate is as low as it is, still believe that it could be lower if immigration policies were tighter.
Yeah, Steve, that's kind of what I was wondering about as well in terms of where this fits into the larger debate around immigration policy. I mean, you have the wall, you have limiting certain kinds of visas, limiting legal immigration, this TPS thing. Do these all lock together as part of one larger immigration policy, or do they kind of point in different directions?
No, we have a sense that the administration wants to not only create a physical wall in the South, but a metaphorical wall around the nation, and to walk away from what the legacy of American success and what America is. In my view, America has been, in a way, the world's brain drain challenge, that the best and brightest minds in the world have come to the United States, studied in American universities, been here. Even at that higher end, the administration is raising doubts and casting itself against that sort of immigration. But I think broadly, refugees and others, when you look at the evidence is very clear that startups, that businesses that get created in the United States are overwhelmingly from those that have come into the country recently, from immigrants. And so we are undermining. What I find fascinating about this particular Judge Edward Chen at the district court is he not only raised concerns about the racial bias and national origin bias that he sensed in the administration's actions. But he raised who was being harmed, that he went to various states and gathered in this a sense that there would be an estimated $132 billion negative impact on GDP, which is to look at the contributions of these 300,000 and other folks. And I do believe, to answer your question clearly, it is a part of the administration's efforts to throw up a wall around the United States and to move America out of that position of being a place that benefits from immigration and those that come into this country.
Earlier this week, the Senate passed the final version of a sweeping package of laws to deal with the opioid crisis in the U.S. It passed on Wednesday afternoon 98-1. The bill also aims to change a rule that prohibited Medicaid from covering some patients with substance abuse disorders. Steve Clemens, let me stick with you for a bit. Can you give us a sense of what this bill would do and what some of the timing might have been behind passing it now?
Well, I think partly they want to reach out to communities that are in high stress. I mean, when you look particularly at non-urban communities, this is a plague that many are dealing with. And so I think it's, when I spoke again to Presidential Counselor Kellyanne Conway, to hear her enthusiasm for this legislation, I believe the administration thinks they need to do this in just before the elections. But it's as you said, it's non-controversial. It's 98-1. We had Mike Lee of Utah as the only opposition vote in this case. And it creates and expands a number of authorities that reauthorizes all the programs for, sort of a blanketing of various efforts to move forward on kind of responding on opioids, because it is, we have communities around the United States feeling like they're hemorrhaging. I have the Eastern Shore of Maryland. We have a drive by the sheriffs, by the hospitals, by others working out in Kent County, Queen Anne's County, places like that. But that's being replicated around the United States, of efforts to highlight opioid response. So there's both the substantive side, but politically, this is one of the items that's riding very high for people who are feeling like they have no options and no support.
If you checked out the New York Times this week, you might have seen it's the results of its year-long investigation. The investigation revealed that President Trump received more than $413 million from his father's real estate empire. That would be no big deal, except that the president has routinely claimed that he only got a million-dollar loan from his father, and he's claimed this a lot.
It has not been easy for me, and I started off in Brooklyn. My father gave me a small loan of $1 million. I came into Manhattan, and I had to pay him back, and I had to pay him back with interest.
I borrowed $1 million, I paid it back, and I built a company that's worth over $10 billion, which is a pretty good return.
Very few people have ever done that. Gave me a very small loan in 1975, and I built it into a company that's worth many, many billions of dollars with some of the greatest
fortune. It was Brooklyn and Queens real estate. And it wasn't a great fortune. But now what they do is they build it up like, oh, he left Donald money. I started off with $1 million, and now I'm worth over $10 billion.
But that's only one piece of the investigation. Also, according to the Times, most of that $413 million came via tax schemes designed by the Trump siblings to deceive the IRS. Some of them involved exploiting legal loopholes. Others, according to the report, were flat-out tax fraud. Susan, this story is a little complex, and I think for some people, it's just a political Rorschach test. Oh, I knew that Donald Trump was crooked. Oh, I knew the New York Times hated Donald Trump. But what's the key takeaway of this? What do we really learn?
Well, look, there's 14,000 words, an 18-month investigation, an extraordinary 8-page print special section of the New York Times. It suggests that reporting, old-fashioned reporting, facts, truth, can be assembled, even if only at great cost. In, you know, this universe that Kellyanne Conway, Steve's, interlocutor, called alternative facts, well, there are still real facts. And ultimately, I think a lot of the rage that you hear around Donald Trump is around the question of whether he's ever going to face accountability. If he can just lie with impunity, as he has done over and over again, you pointed out on this issue of the $1 million loan from his father. As apparently he and his family worked together, according to the New York Times, to evade the law systematically and purposefully. That's not something that the New York Times normally accuses anyone of in unvarnished language, never mind the President of the United States. So I think it's been overlooked a bit in this Kavanaugh fight. It's an extremely important investigation that's worthy of everyone's time.
Are there other big questions that are still out there when it comes to the president's tax history? We still don't have his tax returns provided by him, for example.
I was going to say that's the biggest question. I mean, the reality is this was done over, I believe, 18 months. What has happened since, the piece was published or perhaps the research ended, we still do not know. There are more questions than answers because many of the answers could be provided if we actually had the tax forms, which Sarah Huckabee Sanders pretty much gave us reason to believe earlier this week. We perhaps should not expect. The reality is that this is not an area that Trump desires to be transparent about, and many of his supporters don't demand that he is. I think there are people who have noticed how much wealthier he has gotten since getting in the White House in regarding specific businesses of his. Some of the hotels have been rented out by international organizations, perhaps wanting to curry good favor with the administration. And I think there's some people who are concerned about how that could influence policy, foreign policy specifically.
Well, it's been 4 years since the fatal shooting of black teenager Laquan McDonald by Officer Jason Van Dyke in Chicago. This week marks the end of that closely watched trial as the jury deliberates. We're keeping an eye on the verdict to come. We'll keep you updated on any developments on that. Before we continue with the roundup, a quick word about next week. The Black Lives Matter movement, which the Laquan McDonald case is definitely caught up in, focuses on police shootings of African Americans, and one of the most prominent voices in that movement will join us next week, DeRay McKesson. His new memoir, called On the Other Side of Freedom, appeals for police reform and reminds supporters of Black Lives Matter to keep fighting for awareness of this issue. We'd like to know what questions you have about the Black Lives Matter movement today. Today, or Questions for DeRay McKesson. He tried to turn his activism into elected office when he ran for mayor of Baltimore in 2016. That bid was unsuccessful, but what does it say about where the movement is, and where should it go? Share your questions for activist DeRay McKesson. You can leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. What do you want to know about the Black Lives Matter movement? 855-236-1A1A. You can also use our new app, 1A Vox Pop, where you can leave us a radio quality message or check in on future topics. You'll find 1A Vox Pop, V-O-X-P-O-P, in the App Store, and we will share our conversation with DeRay McKesson coming up next week on 1A. Well, the vote on the Senate floor has just happened. The final vote total, 51 yes, 49 no. And indeed, as Susan said, Senators Collins, Flake, and Manchin voted yes to suspend the debate and move on. Lisa Murkowski voted no, but it seems like for the most part, this was pretty much a party line vote. Eugene Scott, I don't think that we really expected it to go any other way than being essentially a squeaker right down party lines.
Absolutely. I think everything just leading up to this moment suggested that even before the allegations against Kavanaugh became public. And I think there's a larger idea that David Brooks tapped in to today in his New York Times piece about just how partisan the judicial branch has become. We talk often about activist judges and concern that people on the bench are not making decisions impartially, but we haven't seen that be the case for a while now, and this simply appears to be a continuation of that.
I mean, if I may, Joshua, mm-hmm. one other element on this is that it was interesting to note that Heidi Heitkamp's brother tweeted that she has to look at herself every day in the mirror and thus chose to vote no, even though he thinks it significantly increases the chances that she will lose her seat. Joe Manchin, the last time there was a reasonable poll in West Virginia, is looking that 70% of West Virginians likely to vote support the Kavanaugh nomination. So the broader side in terms of the tectonics in the parties as they look at trying to take the Senate, or the Democrats taking the Senate, is also hinging on this, that if Manchin were to be a no vote on Kavanaugh, I think it very seriously could raise the stakes of him losing that state. So there are different issues here. One is what does the future prospects of the composite of the Senate look like with regards to this? And despite the many, many personal, emotional, and deep issues related to the Kavanaugh nomination itself and this lifetime appointment. But many people are looking at Heitkamp as now in a much more endangered position. And this probably, if Manchin follows through with his position on the vote tomorrow, increases the chances that he will survive in November.
Susan?
I think that that's our view right now. But if Kavanaugh gets through, as I think seems a tiny bit more likely after this cloture vote than it did before, because it seems to me that Joe Manchin seems somewhat more likely to vote yes on the nomination than we might have known going into this cloture vote. But if Kavanaugh gets through in the end, I think Joshua made this point earlier in the broadcast, it may or may not actually prove decisive in any of these individual Senate races. It's in Alaska, for example, if Lisa Murkowski, she's a Republican, if she votes no, but the Republican governor and lieutenant governor of her state have come out against Kavanaugh there, particularly in sense not necessarily even about these sexual assault charges, but about a ruling that bears on Native Americans that he made as a judge earlier in his career. And, you know, so she has more political cover, for example, than Joe Manchin, as you pointed out, strong polls in favor of him, in favor of Kavanaugh in West Virginia. So I would just introduce that note of caution. And then there's the cultural impact of this. Women around the country have spent the last couple weeks in an extraordinary display. I've experienced it. I'm sure that all of our listeners have too, in some way.
We have
friends,
here, yeah.
Friends, family, colleagues, parents, grandparents. I had a 60-year-old woman tweet at me during the hearing last week recounting a sexual assault that she'd had that she said she'd never told anyone about. She's 60 years old. This is a cultural moment that is going to affect our politics in ways that are very unclear. You know, sexual assaults don't just happen to Democrats. They don't just happen to Republicans. Mm-hmm. And I think that makes it very, very unclear to understand how this debate that we've had will actually affect our politics.
Can we just step back for a second, Eugene, and just kind of think about the arc of this whole story? I mean, what a long way this whole confirmation has come. When we started, the debate was about, you know, Democrats, progressives being very concerned that Donald Trump would be able to get two people on the U.S. Supreme Court at all. And then with Brett Kavanaugh, it was about, well, what about his time at the White House? We don't have these documents. It's very formative. Maybe we should adjourn this hearing, postpone this hearing. All of the hoops that Democrats jumped through. And then the Christine Blasey Ford thing, just the arc of this whole story is just, it's dizzying.
Absolutely. And when I think about the arc, I go back to the election when I saw dozens of white evangelicals, I mean, thousands, if not millions, hold their noses to vote for Donald Trump because they really believed that he was going to get people like Kavanaugh on not just the Supreme Court, but the benches across the board. Yeah. They wanted. So this is not even about just Kavanaugh at all. I mean, we've heard conversations about Gorsuch in this conversation as well, but it's about what will our benches look like and what direction will the country move on certain issues and what role will Donald Trump play in it. And there's been a strong argument that his lasting legacy ultimately will be the influence that he's had on the benches.
We did want to talk about the new law passed in California related to net neutrality. It would restore those internet access rules since they were rolled back by the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, last year. The Justice Department quickly filed suit against that, asking that California's law, which is supposed to take effect in January, be put on hold until the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals rules on net neutrality. Steve Clemens, give us a sense of what this would mean in terms of this fight over net neutrality.
Well, California, like it has been doing on so many issues, whether it's immigration or climate change, is saying essentially it's creating codes. We haven't discussed women on boards, another very interesting progressive law where California is stepping forward and passing legislation to protect, as it says, the rights of those of the least powerful, the least wealthy, and to make sure that big broadband firms don't have the ability to throttle the data and the programming that people get. And so net neutrality is one of those issues which is a huge issue to the progressive base, and I think now they've come out and do this. I think the companies that are bringing this forward, and it's also the Department of Justice, which is challenging the law, is saying that this is actually going to harm people because some of these firms have low income plans that allow people to get free data and whatnot. And in my personal view, I'm not sure that that's a strong argument, but it does bring back to the fore, right again, right before an election, net neutrality, which was a big rallying cry for many millennials and people across the spectrum. So we have another paralysis, but California is challenging the federal government on all sorts of fronts.
Yeah, and just to clarify that other law that Steve mentioned, California's law makes it the very first in the nation to require that publicly traded companies have at least one woman on their board of directors. There have been similar laws in place in European countries for years, and this California law only applies to companies whose principal executive officers are located in California. Speaking of the Golden State, we will be there next week. 1A will broadcast live a week from today from KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. So we'll be doing the Friday News Roundup from there next week. Also, the Nobel Prizes went out this week. All the laureates for 2018 have been announced. One of the standouts was Donna Strickland, a Canadian physicist, the first woman to win the prize in 55 years and the third woman ever to be a Nobel laureate in physics. The first was Marie Curie back in 1903. Susan, it's interesting. I read some of the reporting about her, and she said she'd always kind of felt like an equal in her business, but this is still a pretty remarkable moment at a pretty remarkable time.
Well, that's right. It's a reminder, of course, of the incredible underrepresentation of women in science that we see. I felt like it was just something that people could cheer about in the midst of this very divisive moment in American politics. It's just a reminder, I think, of how very far we have to go. We're living in a country where there are more male CEOs named John than there are women who run companies. So I wouldn't declare victory just yet.
A few quick comments on Kavanaugh before we go. Leanne writes, I am so disgusted by all senators involved in this. It's all about winning, not who's qualified. But Patrick wrote on our Facebook page, I guarantee if I was falsely accused and then people who don't know anything about the situation were calling me a criminal, I'd be ticked. Kavanaugh's temper tantrum was expected and excusable. Thanks to all our guests today, Steve Clemens, Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic. Steve, thanks for talking to us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Susan Glasser, staff writer for The New Yorker and CNN Global Affairs Analyst. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you so much.
And Washington Post political reporter Eugene Scott. Thanks, Eugene.
Thanks for having me.
1A's lead sound engineer is Jake Cherry. Our digital team is Gabrielle Healy and Catherine Fink. To learn more about them and the rest of our team, visit the1a.org/staff. We'll dive into the international section of the Friday News Roundup in just a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor ADT. America's trusted home security company can help protect you against break-ins, fires, and carbon monoxide. 24/7 emergency response when you need it most. More at ADT.com.
How often do people lie on dating apps? And are robots taking over our jobs? I'm Cardiff Garcia, co-host of Planet Money's The Indicator, where every day we tell you a short story about the economy. Get it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Nobel Peace Prize goes to two people from two different countries for their work helping victims of sexual violence in armed conflict. Also, a big election is coming up in Brazil. More allegations of Russian hacking. Vice President Pence has harsh words for China and Iran. And First Lady Melania Trump goes to Africa. Joining us to discuss this and the big stories from around the world is David Sanger, national security correspondent for The New York Times and the author of The Perfect Weapon: War, Sabotage, and Fear in the Cyber Age. David, welcome back to 1A.
Great to be with you, Joshua.
Vivian Salama covers the White House for The Wall Street Journal. Vivian, welcome.
Thank you.
And NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie, co-author of This Burning Land, Lessons from the Front Lines of the Transformed Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. Greg, glad to have you back.
Good to be here, Joshua.
America and other Western governments hammered Russia's spy network this week. Yesterday, the U.S. indicted seven military spies with links to an Olympic doping scandal. Earlier, Dutch authorities said they had foiled a cyber attack against the International Chemical Weapons Watchdog. Let's explain. Four men working for Russian military intelligence were caught trying to hack the computer network at the headquarters of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, OPCW. That's the group that was investigating the use of chemical weapons in Salisbury, England, that attack on the former Russian spy, and in Syria. Equipment was found in the trunk of a car. There was a Wi-Fi antenna hidden under a jacket on the rear shelf. Reports suggest the set was working when Dutch security officers disrupted the attack. David Sanger, let me start with you. What's going on here?
Well, what's going on here is that we're beginning to see that the DNC hack and everything that we've been obsessed with, rightly so, since the 2016 election, was to the Russians just a small slice of how they have used cyber as the main way that they seek to disrupt and undermine not only foreign governments, but those who would be opponents of Vladimir Putin or those who are busy investigating other Russian malfeasance. So when you go across the indictment and the other data that we got from the British and from the Dutch yesterday and the day before, what it adds up to is as soon as you begin an investigation into Russian malfeasance, you should expect hackers from what was formerly known as the GRU, the military intelligence unit of the Russian military, to be at your doorstep, or in the case of the Chemical Weapons Agency, to be in the Marriott Hotel parking lot across the way. And what they're doing is seeking to get into computer systems, disrupt, steal emails, undercut the legitimacy of the organization. Sound familiar? Exactly what they've been doing in Ukraine, what they've done in European elections, and what they did here in 2016.
Greg, do we have a sense of why they would want to go after these specific organizations, like the anti-doping agency? I mean, Russia did get pinched for doping in recent Olympic games, but does it really matter that much to them?
Oh, I think it does. I think in the Russian mindset, they want to show, hey, you know, you accuse us of cheating. We're going to find others who are cheating. They released information on soccer players, on the Williams sisters, on a wide range of athletes. So I think it follows very much in the way we've seen in them trying to discredit the political system in the U.S. They want to discredit other countries' athletic programs the way they suffered all of the criticism for the doping in the 2014 Sochi Olympics in Russia. And the accusations that they've been involved in poisoning people around the world. So I think they're hitting back every time they're being criticized. They're hitting back. And the GRU, this Russian military intelligence that we didn't hear about for a long time, it was not part of the old KGB, which you may recall, and was broken up. But they've really been at the center for the past decade of most or all of these big Russian hacking scandals.
Vivian, the Department of Justice has brought charges against 7 Russian officers. Scott Brady is the Attorney General for the Western District of Pennsylvania. Here's part of what he had to say.
This is not spy versus spy. These were not passive intelligence gathering operations. This is a criminal conspiracy which caused real harm to real victims. When the GRU publishes U.S. athletes' most private and sensitive medical information to embarrass our national sports federations, we are all made more vulnerable.
That's Attorney General Scott Brady from the Western District of Pennsylvania. Vivian, we've mentioned this on the program before. It almost feels like it was meant to be seen, like some of this was meant to be noticed. It feels very Godfather to me. Like when there's a hit, you don't clean up the blood. You want people to see that something happened and know we did this and we can do worse.
Well, and this is the tactic that the Russians have used time and time again, where they like to leave breadcrumbs when they do these kinds of attacks, and especially in the cyber realm where it might be a little bit harder to detect exactly the source of an attack. You really could be completely anonymous in a lot of these cases if you wanted to be, but the Russians like to kind of mark their territory and say, you know, send a message to the world and say, we have the ability to do this, and essentially put everyone on notice and on guard. And so that's exactly what they've done, not just to the U.S., but around the world.
And just to clarify that title, sorry, it was Scott Brady, the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of Pennsylvania. Sorry about that. It is the Friday News Roundup with Vivian Salama of The Wall Street Journal, NPR's Greg Myrie, and The New York Times reporter David Sanger. David, you wanted to jump back in.
Yeah, just an interesting observation, I think, on Vivian's point here, which is, doing these indictments against people who will never see in U.S. courtrooms, publishing their photographs as the British and the Dutch did, is based on an assumption that there is a deterrent effect in embarrassing the Russians by revealing what they've been doing. Vivian's exactly right. Since some of this is meant to show your power, it's not clear to me that Vladimir Putin is embarrassable here. In fact, he may like the additional publicity that comes from this, considering that there are no real penalties to him. I mean, 4 of their guys got thrown out of Amsterdam after being caught 30 minutes into their operation. What does that tell you? It tells you that we still have not figured out the core issues of how to deter cyber attacks. And the old assumption that doing it in secret is the goal is wrong. And, you know, there was a moment when after President Trump met Vladimir Putin in Hamburg a year ago, and I recount this in The Perfect Weapon, he came out of that meeting and he called me from Air Force One to make the point that Vladimir Putin had told him the Russians are so good at cyber that if they had done the DNC hack, they never would have been caught.
And so, Vladimir Putin
argued
to Donald Trump that we're so good at what we do that if we had done the DNC hack, you never would have known.
You never would have seen us.
And the president called you to tell you this.
To tell me this, and he's since made this argument in public many times. And he called me to say, so that sounds about right. And I said, well, you know, Mr. President, I don't think that was the intent of this hack. They published the emails of the DNC. They published John Podesta's emails. They meant to be seen.
Well,
did not seem to register.
He didn't actually come out and push back on the notion that the Russians were behind it. He kind of cast it as, well, maybe it was a patriotic Russian who did it and wasn't actually a government official. And so he would sort of jump around and keep you guessing
as far as Putin.
I'm talking about Putin, of course, is the source of the attack and the motivation behind it.
And the president complied with that. And when Vice President Pence went out and gave a speech yesterday about Chinese influence, you didn't hear Russia mentioned other than to say the Chinese are worse.
I do want to get into what the vice president said in just a little bit, but great contrast that, what we just heard about the president, with what we heard from Britain's foreign minister, Jeremy Hunt, basically saying, you know, hey, Russia, who are you trying to kid?
Here is clear evidence of the Russian military trying to conduct a cyber attack on the very international organization whose job it was to look into those Novichok attacks. And why would you do that if you weren't the guilty party?
That was Britain's foreign minister, Jeremy Hunt. Now, a spokeswoman for Russia's foreign ministry, Maria Zakharova, dismissed the allegations as a, quote, delusional and diabolical perfume blend, unquote. I'm not sure I can buy that, but I love the imagery.
Very telling. We don't get that a lot.
It's florid.
What we're seeing is a release of remarkable details. The intelligence agencies of Western countries, the Dutch, the British, the Americans, are releasing details that we would never before see. Passport numbers, middle names of the people doing this, all, you know, putting this out. So it's interesting the level of detail, which the public generally has not seen in the past. But I think we're still sort of seeing Western countries stumped on exactly how do you respond. They're showing how much material they have. They're naming and shaming. But how do you respond beyond that? And that's still the question we're wrestling with.
Well, and maybe we can't. Like, maybe that's what this means, is that there just is no effective international deterrent for these kind of attacks, at least not yet.
That's a huge issue. Who owns the internet? I mean, that's kind of what it boils down to, is that nobody really has jurisdiction over the internet and cannot, therefore, like, impose any legal restrictions as far as what people do. And this is something that's argued in the legal community all the time.
With regards to cyber hacking, Michael asks, with the loss and resultant widespread dissemination of the CIA toolkit, which allows one to spoof hacking from another country, how can cyber breadcrumbs lead to certainty that another country is actually guilty? David, what do you think?
Well, cyber attribution is something that people are getting a lot better at. Certainly, there are lots of ways to make it appear that a cyber attack came from other places. When the New York Times was attacked by the Chinese and its computer systems years ago, it looked like the attack was coming from a university in the southern part of the U.S. But the fact of the matter is that a combination of forensic evidence, motive, past use of similar tools can get you most of the way most of the time. So there are some pretty good ways to go do it. The bigger question facing many governments is, once they've found this out and perhaps decide to announce it, as happened in these most recent cases, then the political pressure is on them. So what do you do about it? That's why the president signed a new set of executive orders in August. We haven't seen them. They're all classified. That pushes down into the system the ability for commanders in the U.S. to do cyber attacks back without having presidential sign off. Till now, that's been something that only the president could authorize the use of nuclear weapons and cyber weapons. Now it's not entirely clear that only he can authorize the use of cyber weapons in retaliation. But you want to make sure your attribution's pretty good before you strike back.
So you know who to attack. Yeah. Greg Myrie, before we move on from this, first of all, that is no small thing, that the U.S. military might have the latitude unilaterally to shut down a power grid or turn off a hydroelectric dam through the internet. But beyond that, do we have a sense that certain countries, certain organizations are getting a better handle on dealing with cyber attacks? The world clearly hasn't figured this out. Is anyone making progress? I think about the EU because I hear so much about internet regulations from there on a consumer level, but on a military level, is anyone making progress?
Not that I'm aware of. The U.S., I think, is still the world leader in terms of advanced internet abilities, and the threats are pretty clear: Russia, China, North Korea, Iran. But figuring out a response and how you want to calibrate that response so it doesn't become this open-ended escalation and you don't know the capabilities of your rivals if you respond, you're entering really uncharted territory.
Vivian, do we get a sense of countries beginning to kind of work together to figure this out, to figure out some kind of international response to cyber attacks, or has Russia really got the whole world kind of running with its hair on fire.
Well, obviously, what we've seen in the last couple of days was this coordination of indictments and, you know, raising these concerns about spying and otherwise. Obviously, there's a lot of discussions that are taking place where countries, Western allies, trying to coordinate some kind of effort to counter this threat that the Russians pose. But at the same time, again, you have so many restrictions and so many uncertainties as to how to approach the cyber world in general and cyber threats. As David said, the U.S. trying to really formulate some sort of attack plan or something to counter and to protect our infrastructure so that we don't have, we're not as vulnerable as we've seen ourselves in the past. But obviously, you know, the U.S. is still trying to figure out a way forward, having looked at what happened to us in the 2016 election. Still, we're talking about the fact that we are vulnerable in 2018. We could be vulnerable in 2020. So we haven't actually quite figured out how to protect ourselves, let alone the world kind of coordinating on a global scale to do the same. It's not an easy task.
Although it's funny, kind of the decentralization of the way that we vote, that we have so many different kinds of voting systems, might, in a way, kind of...
Oh, it helps a lot.
It helps insulate us from a kind of coordinated
same way
attack.
The fact that we've got all these different utility companies
yeah.
that, you know, don't... But the key element here is we've done a better job at discussing internally how we would do counterattacks than we have organizing the world in a sort of digital Geneva Convention mm-hmm. of what standards of what's on limits and off limits.
Let's shift gears and talk about the Nobel Prizes, particularly the Nobel Peace Prize. The winners were announced this morning. Dr. Denis Mukwege and Nadia Murad won for their work combating sexual violence as a weapon of war. The announcement from the Nobel Committee said in part, quote, Denis Mukwege is the helper who has devoted his life to defending these victims. Nadia Murad is the witness who tells of the abuses perpetrated against herself and others. Murad is an Iraqi woman. She was captured and held by the Islamic State, escaped captivity after 3 months, and told to her story in a book called The Last Girl. Dr. Mukwege founded a hospital in eastern Congo that's treated thousands of women, many of whom are survivors of gang rape. Greg Myrie, two pretty extraordinary people to be winning this prize, especially as we've learned more about how sexual violence is being used as a weapon of war and has for quite some time.
Yeah, really has. Two individuals who seem really deserving. The Peace Prize has been had a lot of controversy in recent years, very politicized. A couple people who've really been thrust into dangerous situations, handled it with incredible courage. And Dr. Mukwege built this hospital in eastern Congo, which is in the middle of nowhere, just a very remote region. 20 years ago for maternal care. There just isn't much health care. That was his intent. But as the Congolese civil war metastasized, rape became a huge issue, a huge problem. The various factions, UN peacekeepers were involved in rape there. And so he became the voice of rape being used as a weapon of war. And so he's been at this for 20 years, very prominent voice, but still operating in a very dicey region, very deserving winner.
Vivian?
I can really speak for the case of Ms. Murad, who I spent a lot of time in Iraq in 2015-16 interviewing Yazidi women who were released from captivity from ISIS. And the impact, obviously psychologically, physically, this use of sexual assault and rape as a tool in war is obviously a huge thing. But you have to also remember that these women try to go back home. A lot of their families shun them because of cultural sensitivities to such things. And so their lives are essentially upended by this. Their families, a lot of times, don't take them back home. A lot of these women were impregnated as a result of this and had really nowhere to go because they were single mothers, which in Iraq is just completely taboo. And so, you know, it's something that raising awareness for this is something really, really important. And you had a lot of people on the ground in Iraq trying to educate these families that this is not of no fault to the women, that they had no say in the matter. But obviously, you know, changing cultural perceptions, it's an uphill battle. And so this woman obviously trying to do that. And it's worth the notoriety that she's getting.
Let's shift gears and talk about China. Vice President Mike Pence spoke yesterday accusing China of trying to sway American public opinion and undermine the Trump administration.
To put it bluntly, President Trump's leadership is working, and China wants a different American president. There can be no doubt. China is meddling in America's democracy.
David, what does Vice President Pence mean by meddling? What do we know about what China actually is doing?
Well, it's pretty fascinating because he is appropriating the language of the Russian attacks on the 2016 election and transferring it over to a different set of activities that the Chinese are involved in. Now, there's no question that the Chinese have used cyber before for political purposes, but they largely haven't used it here. They've used it in Taiwan. They've used it in their arguments with Tibet. They've used it internally a lot. They've used it to some degree in Australia and New Zealand. But what he is arguing is that in putting together retaliatory tariffs, tariffs that are retaliating for tariffs the United States put on China, they are aiming at states and districts that are key to President Trump and therefore causing pain to workers there. And they're saying that that accounts to meddling. Well, if that's the case, we've done the same thing in foreign countries where we, when we impose tariffs, frequently do it with a political goal in mind. You're trying to change the political behavior of a country. The Japanese did it to the United States, both in the negative sense with tariffs, but also in the positive sense, putting facilities, mostly car plants, in key districts where they want to make sure they maintain some interest. So there's not a whole lot that is new here. What is interesting is that the administration is doing now a broad spectrum attack on Chinese activity. Today, the president is doing something involving the supply chain of parts, critical parts to the military and others that the Chinese provide. There was this encounter in the South China Sea earlier this week in which a Chinese military vessel came within, I think, about 45 feet.
45 yards. Yeah, and actually, yards. I have a clip from Vice President Pence speaking about this. He commented on that during his speech. Here's part of what the vice president said.
Despite such reckless harassment, the United States Navy will continue to fly, sail, and operate wherever international law allows and our national interests demand. We will not be intimidated, and we will not stand down.
Greg Myrie, what was the big deal with this ship other than just such a close call?
Well, I think it's that, but as to pick up on David's point, it's pointing to military issues, it's pointing to political issues, it's pointing to economic issues. It's this full spectrum of discussion. We had an interesting development this week. The Chinese ambassador, Sui Tian Kai, came to NPR and was very generous with his time, took questions from reporters, and gave a lengthy interview. And it was very diplomatic and talking about the difficulty of reading this president, saying China wants to come to an agreement, but the president of this administration keeps changing its policy. So it was interesting to get the Chinese read on this through the ambassador. And he was very diplomatic most of the way. And then there were a few questions where he was asked about, why can't journalists go to Tibet? And he said, and then he sort of lost it, and he sort of said, the altitude is too high. It would be risky to their health to go there. So, we're seeing a lot more at this sort of top-level discussion, and altitude apparently is the problem in Tibet. That's what's keeping journalists out of there.
Vivian, what is your sense of what's behind this? I mean, you know, President Trump and China's President Xi Jinping have had kind of an interesting relationship where you have China, this nation that is definitely kind of feeling itself on the world stage and being kind of aggressive in its own neighborhood, and these two kind of frenemies in President Trump and President Xi that seem to want to have an amicable relationship, but then there's all these tariffs. What do you think might be China's motivation here? There is something, I think, to this idea of dueling tariffs and this idea that two Navy vessels can't come within 45 yards of one another unless they mean it. That's not a close call. Like, what's behind this?
Well, I mean, there's a number of issues, and this whole thing we've seen growing since the campaign, frankly, where the president then candidate Trump used to accuse China of currency manipulation and all kinds of other unfair trade practices. He hadn't really delved into the foreign policy sphere until really he got into office. But obviously North Korea being one of the major efforts for his foreign policy agenda now, and making progress with Kim Jong-un and having, you know, trying to achieve denuclearization in North Korea, he really wanted the Chinese on board with him throughout this process. And it really took a long time for him even to be able to achieve any kind of understanding with the North Koreans. And he was growing very impatient last year, asking China repeatedly to try to help in, you know, bringing North Korea to the table. Obviously, he kept on saying he'd do it on his own. He is frequently expressed his frustration with President Xi and China in general on its lack of effort to really rein in Kim Jong-un in the process. And so you had that element of it, but then you also have the economic element of it, which is a very legitimate concern for the president, especially as we head into the midterms. This is He's out there campaigning right now. This is the biggest kind of win that he brings to these rallies, where he says, "Look at this! I'm fighting for you. America is winning again, and you know, I'm bringing jobs back, and I'm bringing companies back to America." And a big issue for him has always been unfair trade practices with China, and this is something that his administration right now is heavily focused on as a way to try to come to terms with. You have the two largest economies in the world. How do we sort of coexist in a way that we can mutually benefit, but in President Trump's mind, also have the Americans come out on top? So these are the issues.
So I did a quick little Google search. Looks like highest point. Let's see, we've got Everest Base Camp, which is 17,000 feet in elevation. The highest, I think, non-Everest point is at about 4,500 meters, which is just under 15,000 feet in elevation. Worth noting, California's highest point is Mount Whitney, which is 15,000 feet. Arizona's highest point, Humphreys Peak, is about 12,600 feet. Alaska's highest point, Mount McKinley in Denali National Park, 20,000 feet. So I think we could survive in Tibet. Just a guess. I think we got like a mask or an oxygen tank or something. We can figure it out.
Let's be fair. Journalists are not the fittest group, but
thank you. Speak for yourself, Greg Myrie. Do not. Please, don't impugn me. I would love to. I would be terrified, but I would at least give it a shot. Let's move on and talk about Iran. After the Trump administration abandoned that nuclear deal negotiated, I'm sorry, actually, before we get to Iran, one more comment, David, that I'd like you to react to regarding China. Chuck U. Farley wrote on our website, the1a.org, "Oh, it's China that's meddling in our politics, not the guys hacking and colluding and Novichoking." Whew, that's a relief.
Yeah, well, the biggest problem with the Pence speech was not what he said, it's what he didn't say. So if you go back to the national security strategy that the administration turned out in January, it referred to two revisionist powers, Russia and China. They're very different. Russia is a declining economy. It's got all kinds of growth and survival issues of its own. But it's a huge disruptor and, of course, a major nuclear power. In China, you have a rising power, and you've got the classic clash between the rising power and a status quo power. That would be us. It's sort of what we went through with the British 150 years ago. So the question now is, why does the administration just focus on the Chinese part of this and not on the Russian part? And that gets to all of your favorite theories about what reason Donald Trump may have for not being critical of Vladimir Putin. I agree with Vivian that the base issues that he's raising with China are absolutely right. He's overinvested in the personal relationship, both in the case of Xi Jinping and, of course, with Kim Jong-un.
Let's talk about Iran. After the Trump administration abandoned the nuclear deal that was negotiated during President Obama's tenure and reimposed sanctions, Iran took the U.S. to court, the International Court of Justice. Tehran argued that the U.S. actions violated the terms of the 1955 Treaty of Amity. Well, the Trump administration hit back this week. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced on Wednesday that the U.S. is ending that treaty.
This is a decision, frankly, that is 39 years overdue. In July, Iran brought a meritless case in the International Court of Justice alleging violations of the Treaty of Amity. Iran seeks to challenge the United States' decision to cease participation in the Iran nuclear deal and to reimpose the sanctions that were lifted as a part of that deal. Iran is attempting to interfere with the sovereign rights of the United States to take lawful actions necessary to protect our national security. And Iran is abusing the ICJ for political and propaganda purposes.
That was Secretary of State Mike Pompeo speaking on Wednesday. Vivian Salama, some have said that ending this treaty is largely symbolic. Is that so?
It is in a lot of ways. I think in general, it's more just reinforcing the administration's standing efforts to withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal and crack down on Iran and kind of show that they're not messing around. And so basically, this was just one more step in that process. But as far as any real changes on the ground, it really doesn't do much. It's really just a response to the International Court of Justice's ruling that essentially said that sanctions, the reimposing of sanctions, were not fair to Iran.
Greg Myrie, step back for just a second. What is this Treaty of Amity?
I'm sure that was a question at the State Department. I just had this vision of some low-level staffer going through the basement looking Treaty of Amity.
I had to Google it, I confess. I did read the whole thing through.
Well, because we've heard about, you know, this the big acronym, the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. But what is this Treaty of Amity?
Well, in 1953, the U.S. helped orchestrate a coup in Iran, bringing the Shah of Iran back to power. They were U.S. and Iran. We're buddy-buddy at that time. And so 2 years later, it's, yeah, you brought me back to power. Sure. Treaty of Amity, great. And they were indeed good friends from 53 until the 79 revolution.
So this is the Shah who was deposed in the Islamic Revolution.
In the Islamic Revolution of 79. So for 39 years, there has been no amity between the U.S. and Iran. This, again, seems very symbolic, just a last little relic that somehow didn't get shredded after the revolution in 79.
It was the last hurrah of Kermit Roosevelt, grandson of Theodore Roosevelt, CIA operative who almost single-handedly staged this coup, and then they got everybody who he put in power to go sign the treaty. Poor Kermit, he's getting no respect in the State Department these days.
My man's name is Kermit Roosevelt.
That's it.
I'm digging it. I like that name. For a man who had such a place in history, Kermit Roosevelt. And noteworthy American. David, is there any real effect in terms of the sanctions, the consequences to the U.S. for refusing to lift them, if this Treaty of Amity is more symbolic? Where might there be more tangible impacts to come?
So the tangible impact is November, when President Trump has said that he will impose the full sanctions on Iran. He's given allies warning that this is coming. And those sanctions, if he does it as he has pronounced, would say to any company around the world, but particularly European companies, if you do business with Iran, you're not doing business with the United States. And it's an effort to choke off the Iranians by making the big aircraft makers, Boeing's already pulled out, the big oil production equipment makers, all get out of Iran. And they're doing that. What's happening now, though, is that the Europeans are saying, we're going to find a method to buy oil from Iran without clearing it in dollars so that the U.S. can't affect it with its sanctions. And a number of us went up and met with the Iranian foreign minister when he was at the U.N. Last week. And he made an argument to us, this was Saturday evening, that he believed that this method was going to come together. So we're heading toward a conflict between the U.S. and its European allies over Iran.
Do we have a sense, Vivian, I feel like the big issue really is Iran's nuclear program and the argument from the other nations who are still signatories to this deal, the Iran nuclear deal, is that it's not perfect, but it's good, and that it has done something to impede Iran's ability to develop a nuclear weapon. Do we have a sense of where we stand in that regard? Setting the economic stuff aside for a moment, does this put us any closer on that path? Are we still kind of in a holding pattern? I mean, what does that look like?
Well, the Europeans, as you say, they consistently say that they don't want two North Koreas. I mean, this is, of course, before we became buddy-buddy and President Trump declared that he and Kim Jong-un were in love. We didn't want two North Koreas in the sense that we didn't want these two very active, potentially rogue nuclear states. And so a checked Iran was always going to be better than an unchecked Iran. And so that was the Europeans' argument as to why the nuclear deal had to continue despite its imperfections. And so the issue is that as far as violations to the actual denuclearization goes, that is not something that's come up as an issue. Consistently, Iran has been found to be in compliance with those promises of the nuclear agreement. And so that's been a lot of the pushback to President Trump's decision to withdraw from the nuclear agreement is if they're complying, why would you do it? So the administration has sort of catered its policy to instead really focus on destabilization efforts that the Iranians are doing in the Middle East, sending help to Syria, sending fighters to Yemen, etc., you know, helping Hezbollah in Lebanon. All of these issues are what the administration underscores as the reason that Iran needs to be kept in check, is that if you clamp down on Iran and the funds that go into the coffers in Iran with the government, you know, getting rich and basically prospering off of this, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard prospering off of this nuclear deal, then Iran is just going to wreak havoc all over the Middle East. And so that's sort of the way that they've catered their argument to get around the actual nuclear issue.
Greg, what happens next in this standoff? Now that the Treaty of Amity has apparently been torn up, what now?
Well, that's been the big question. The administration wants to put a lot of pressure on Iran. It's inflicting some real hurt to its economy. Its currency's falling through the floor. Its oil exports are already going down. But does the Trump administration really want to reopen the negotiations and perhaps wring out a few more concessions? And would it be willing to do that to get a slightly tougher nuclear deal with Iran? It's not really clear that's what they want. There's the clear effort to put the pressure on Iran, but is it just to get a little better nuclear deal? Is it regime change, which has been the sort of wish of every administration for 40 years? What exactly does the administration want for all this pressure it's trying to put on Iran?
Regarding the Iran deal, Faisal tweeted, "The U.S. violated an international agreement done via UN Security Council resolution by leaving the Iran deal. The deal is working. Trump leaving is a violation of international law." It's been 1 week since a 7.5 earthquake struck Indonesia, sending a massive tsunami over the island of Sulawesi and its capital, Palu. The latest update from rescuers on the ground puts the death toll over 1,500 people. Many more are still missing. The 18-foot wave took many people by surprise. The earthquake caused the soil in some areas to liquefy, causing buildings to collapse as the ground slid beneath them. Some say part of the problem was that the tsunami warning system was out of service. We spoke earlier this week to Louise Comfort of the University of Pittsburgh. She's part of a team that's designing a new underwater tsunami warning system for that area. You'll find that conversation online at the1a.org. First Lady Melania Trump is spending this week and early next week on her first solo international trip as First Lady. First stop on her week-long tour of four African nations was in Ghana. She got a tour of the historic Cape Coast Castle. The castle is this big fort that served as a prison and an embarkation point for slaves that were sold into the transatlantic slave trade. It holds the infamous Door of No Return, which was the last place many slaves walked through before they stepped onto slave ships. She spoke to reporters after signing the fort's guest book, thanking her hosts for what she called a warm welcome.
"And this is a very special place. I will never forget. Incredible experience. And the stories that I heard from the gentlemen, it's really, really touching. And the dungeons that I saw, it's really something that people should see and experience. And what happened so many years ago, it's really a tragedy."
This is also the same castle that the Obama family visited early in the presidency in 2009, after which President Obama said the castle, quote, "reminds us of the capacity of human beings to commit great evil," unquote. David Sanger, President Trump has not had the best relationship with African nations. There was that moment where he referred to some of them as blank hole countries. The First Lady started in Ghana, flew to Malawi and Southern Africa. She's in Kenya today. What impact might this trip have?
He has been going out of his way to try to send emissaries ever since he made those comments. it also seems clear he's not in a huge hurry to go himself. He did send his Secretary of State to Africa on a lengthy trip. That was just before he fired his Secretary of State. That was earlier this year. What's, I think, been striking about Melania Trump's trip, from just reading the reports of our own correspondents who are traveling along, is she seems to be having a good time. She's doing her diplomacy by herself. She seems to be happy being out of Washington. One can hardly blame her for those purposes. But she, this is one of the first times where you've seen her take up a pretty traditional role, First Lady's role of goodwill ambassador.
And finally this week, no matter where you are in the world, politicians on the campaign trail, it's usually a new opportunity to set the mood, to rally the crowd, to drive home your vision for a better future. Usually something like this is preceded by a little bit of motivational music.
Just a small town girl, living in a lonely world. She took the midnight train going anywhere.
Here in the U.S., we stick to some favorites. Clinton and Romney wheeled out This Journey classic. Mike Dukakis liked America by Neil Diamond. George Bush was a Tom Petty fan with I Won't Back Down. Barack Obama kept Springsteen basically on a loop, and some U2 as well. But if you're Britain's prime minister, known for being a little stiff, a little formal, your musical choices might be a bit more restricted. This week, you could say Britain's Theresa May found her mojo. Mrs. May became the dancing queen when she bounded on stage in the UK to close her party conference dancing. Kind of. Brexit is looming, but she wasn't afraid to make fun of herself after a previous video of her awkwardly grooving went kind of viral. At least she picked a good ABBA track, like one of these number one hits. I'm not even sure what to make of this. This seems to be a really rough time to be Theresa May right now.
Theresa May cannot resist shaking her hips to music. She's done this before. Maybe shouldn't go so far, but, you know, she's having fun. I guess that's what counts.
Might as well. Vivian Salama of The Wall Street Journal, we had fun with you this week. Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
David Sanger of The New York Times, author of The Perfect Weapon. Thanks, David.
Thanks for having me.
And NPR's Greg Myrie, co-author of This Burning Land. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you, Joshua.
Our senior team is Danielle Knight, Denise Couture, Lindsay Foster Thomas, and Gabe Bullard. You can meet more of our team online at theonea.org/staff. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. Enjoy your weekend. This is 1A. You are the-